The retirement and IRA show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salnier and Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Salnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Well, hello and welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show Q&A edition for this week. Got what I believe to be some really nice questions lined up. We generally do. And I think today's show is going to be pretty standard. I am going to reveal that I'm not really looking forward to this weekend because mowing season is going to be back in full force here in Colorado after our respite over the winter. Because we just got a whole bunch of rain, which a bunch of rain for Colorado style. I'm sure Jim will point out that a few days of soaking rain is not a whole bunch of rain. But for us, it is, and it's going to set alight the growth in my lawn. So I always try to wait as long as possible before I have to mow, and I'm afraid it's going to be upon me again. So it is what it is. Green is nicer than brown, so that's the good news. But I'll be mowing this weekend, I'm 90% sure. Jim, on the other hand, is probably getting ready to do a bunch of planting in his garden. We do mostly container gardens here at my house, so we don't do a whole lot. But Jim's probably been delayed with all this rain. It's probably a muddy mess at in his garden. Have you got your planting underway?
My planting has been going on strong for weeks now. I've got quite a bit in my leeks, my onions, my scallions, my shallots, peas,
you've
kale,
had them in the ground
spinach,
already?
Lettuce. Oh, yeah, they're already growing.
Oh, huh.
Already, yeah. That's all cool season crops. We don't have cold winters here, Chris. So,
well, it still freezes, but I guess that stuff, before it comes up, it can
withstand. That stuff can handle it. The stuff can handle it. So, no, everything is growing. In fact, I had my first salad yesterday with lettuce and kale from my garden.
Hmm. Nice. Is kale is kind of kale-y when it's fresh from the garden compared to normal kale, or is fresh kale you just cut an hour ago superb?
I love kale, so I don't know what you mean by kale-y. Yes, it's kale-y because it's kale, but is it any different than the stuff you buy in the store? I think it is. No different than if you ever tasted a fresh tomato and then a tomato in the store.
Oh, sure.
You can usually tell the difference. Mm-hmm. But no, my kale, I just go out and snip it right before eating it, and it's fine.
I like kale. I have no problem with kale.
Okay. Very good.
I'm
very
just
good.
Curious. Well, I don't think I've ever had kales like straight out of the garden. I might have.
But I am surprised you said you haven't mowed yet. I've already mowed my property twice.
Hmm.
I don't know how you go without mowing. And I don't water, so it's whatever we get. Mm-hmm. And seriously, you must, because I do, pretty much after May, when like a light switch, folks, our quote-unquote rainy season, folks, in Colorado is March, April, and May. And by that, I mean exactly what Chris described. We can go a day or two of clouds and on and off rain. The East Coast or even Midwest all day or multi-day long rainstorms where it just pounds down inches at a time. and it can last 3-4 days. No, we don't get that even in March, April, or May. But we can go a couple of days where we have some on and off, quote unquote, rain, and it makes things green. But like a light switch, that'll turn off in another couple of weeks. Mm-hmm. And then at best we can get is an afternoon storm. And in June, they can be severe and you can get some hush, hush thunderstorms or hail out of them. But pretty much from June through, I'd say, August, it's all afternoon storms for us. The notion of an all-day summer rainstorm never happens.
Yeah.
So my point is, Chris, I mow. My mowing season, if you will, starts in April and will run till about mid-June. And then, honestly, I don't mow except maybe every 6 weeks. Now, if you're mowing every week or two, maybe you're watering too much in the summer.
Well, I like my grass to remain green colored, so yes, we water. But I can't imagine mowing every 6 weeks. You must have some kind of strange variety of grass at your house.
I don't know. Well, it does get quite tall. I am single, so I don't have a wife hounding me. Get out and mow the grass! So I will admit it probably gets longer than what someone who has a house that affronts multi-neighbors on a nice public street and everybody can see it. Yeah, I can understand. Mine, you've been to my house. You've seen it's off of a county road. Yeah. It's surrounded with juniper bushes. Nobody can see my lawn. Mm. So I'll let it get quite long. And in the summer, that's good. You don't want to keep short grass in the summer, especially in the hot, hot, dry days like we get. So yeah, literally, I mow my grass, I would say, a total of about 6 times, maybe 7 throughout the year. Mm. And then I stop mowing permanently in September. I stop watering and mowing. Yeah. I'll do one last water, one last mow, and then that's it.
And you're done.
And I'm done.
Yeah, I can't quite get away with that schedule, but it is what it is. At least I have a riding lawnmower, although I have a lot of grass.
That's the other thing.
I've got about 40,000 square feet of grass to mow, so it's a lot.
Yeah, I have less than, I probably have about 3, maybe 4, I never really mentioned it, measured it. But when I fertilize with a bag that is going to cover 5,000 square feet, I always have extra. So I know it's less than 5, so it's not that big either. Yeah. But I did get my final Honda lawnmower. If anybody likes Honda engines, which I absolutely love on lawnmowers and any power equipment, my wood splitter has a Honda. It's not a Honda wood splitter, but I paid extra for having a Honda engine put on it. My cultivator is a Honda engine. My tiller is a Honda engine. My power washer, Honda engine. Honda stopped making gas engines for their lawnmowers.
What?
So what you see is what you get. If you're lucky to even get one now, I went to a local dealer in Longmont who still had a few left. And if you take care of one, my lawnmower, until I bought the new one when I found out you can't get them anymore, my lawnmower was 13 years old. Honda still starts with one pull. I kid you not, Chris or listeners. Now, I do take care of it. It's tuned up every 3 years. Remember, I only mow for about 6 weeks, 6 times, maybe 7 during the year. So I tune it up every 3 years, sharpen the blade, change the air filter, change the spark plug, and that Honda starts constantly. So my old Honda is now relegated to mowing my garden area, where I like to mow the grass between my rows of crops. And the new Honda that I bought is going to become my new lawn, my new nice one, which will come to Ohio with me. And I'm sure in Ohio it'll get used a lot more, Chris, because of all the rain they do get out there. But yes, if you like Honda and Honda mowers, this is it. No more. They've gone all electric. And I'm sorry, electric isn't quite there yet to mow, especially me when I let the grass grow 4 or 5 inches and then go out and try to mow it. You're not going to do that with a electric mower. So anyways, they've gone all electric, and if you want that nice Honda gas, go get your mower before you can't anymore.
Yeah, my Honda walk behind is over 20 years old, and I have no need to replace it because it's still great.
But you can't get them anymore, so for that very reason, there's your need. Because it's not going to last forever, and then you're going to say, oh God, why didn't I listen to Jim 2 years ago or 2 weeks ago.
I think I might last
and
forever.
Get a Honda while I could.
Yeah, we'll see.
Just sharing.
I don't use that Honda. Much. I usually use my riding does most mower does most of the work. The walk behind is just little trimming up here and there. So it's a but very
your
low
Honda
use
must
at this
stop
point.
With one pull as well. I mean, it's amazing.
Yeah, it's good.
So anyway, sorry, folks.
Welcome
go down
to the
this,
lawn and garden show.
Yeah, the lawn and garden episode of the Retirement and IRA Show Q&A session. But I guarantee you, someone just listened to this and they're going to get a Honda mower. They're like, oh my God, I didn't realize I can't get a gas power Honda walk behind anymore. So we did help someone. I know someone out there is going to go buy a Honda now because they just found out Honda does not make gas. And they announced this a while ago. I didn't realize it. I was dropping my chainsaw off to get tuned up, and a friend of mine gave me a chainsaw that doesn't work. He's like, hey, do you want this? It doesn't work. So I says, well, depends on how much it's going to cost to get it to work. So anyways, I took it to the place that does my chainsaws, and we were talking about mowers. And he says, well, you know, those Hondas on the floor are the last ones. You can't get them anymore, and he's the one who told me. So he it worked well for him because I bought one. Mm-hmm. But I went home first and Googled it to make sure he wasn't BSing me. And right. Sure enough, they don't make gas engines anymore. And they announced it at some point last year. And he said, yeah, he says, what we have is we're just trying to get rid of those. In fact, he was having a 20% off sale on steel. So I bought a steel brush cutter. I says, you're going to take 20% off the Honda? And he laughed. He says, what, are you crazy? You can't get these anymore. I'm not going to take 20% off them. What I have is what I have. So I couldn't get 20% off of the Honda.
Bummer.
Bummer for sure. But I did get a brush cutter for 20% off, so that was good. Okay, let's jump into the first question, which, Chris, is not really a question.
Oh.
Well, yeah, it's going to be something different. You know me, I like to be different. And I appreciate this person writing it. She said some thoughts on estate planning and IRAs. I'm going to skip those. I do want to thank her for sending them just the same. But she did chat quite a bit about Social Security. And it's kind of a PSA, public service announcement. But I think on these, she has 5 bullet points she wants to address on Social Security. This is a retiree. They waited to 70, as you'll see, to claim. And she wants to just share some things that she has experienced. But there's enough here, Chris, where you definitely could take a page out of Jim's playbook and go down a little bit of a rabbit hole and teach people a little bit. So this is going to be the only quote-unquote question we do on Social Security, but it's technically, folks, 5 different things that this retiree wanted everybody to know about her experience with Social Security.
Okay. Sounds good.
Sounds good?
Yeah.
Excellent. Okay. So she begins very formal. Good afternoon, Mr. Solnier and Mr. Stein.
That is much more formal than usual, yeah.
Let me read her signature line. We'll call her Georgette. Nope, I thought maybe she worked in corporate America or academia, and she was calling us Mr. But Mr. Solnier and Mr. Stein. Below are a few of my experiences I thought you may want to share as you deem appropriate. So again, we're going to limit her discussion to just the Social Security folks. I do want to thank this listener, though, for her IRA and estate thoughts as well. So her first recommendation, Chris, check your Social Security statement for accurate earnings. Both my husband and I have errors. 1 year, my earnings were totally dropped, I assume due to a name change I had with marriage. 1 year, my husband had part-time earnings credited, but not his full-time earnings for that year. Previously, it said you could only correct earnings within so many years, but I was able to get them both corrected. Mm-hmm. And that intrigued me, Chris. First mm-hmm. of all, I think the recommendations to check is very important. I never thought with a name change that could cause an issue, and name changes happen all the time with marriages, especially the last name, obviously. But I was also intrigued, and she adds no more background, but you have often talked, and correct me if I'm wrong, is this the 2 years, 2 months, 3 day rule?
Or yeah, some silly little bizarro rule? Yeah. So your earnings record, which is what ultimately determines your Social Security benefit, is sometimes has an error on it, as this person is describing. And for that reason, we encourage people to check their earnings record at least every couple of years. And you can do it easily now. Back in the day, you'd have to wait for your annual Social Security statement to come out, which everyone used to get right around their birthday. Those of you listening, I'm sure, remember those days. And on there was a detailed list of all of your earnings record that had been recorded since the year after you were born, you know, if you actually had any going back that far. And so that's how you check it. You'd look at it and maybe verify it against your tax returns or something to make sure the number looked right on there. Nowadays, they don't send you that annual report anymore, that statement. The easiest way to look at your earnings record is log into your online account at Social Security. If you haven't set that up already, I highly recommend you do so. The earlier you claim it and have your identity verified, the harder it would be for someone to fake your identity and somehow take control of your Social Security online account, which then would be a great inconvenience to try to reclaim it. So I encourage everyone, if you haven't already, get signed up on ssa.gov so you can access your account, where you'll be able to do things like initiate a claim or what have you, but you can also check your earnings record on there at any time. And the reason why we've always historically recommended people check that earnings record every couple of years is that there is a formal rule that you only are supposed to have 3 years, 3 months, and 15 days from the year the earnings are incorrect in order to correct your earnings record. However, I have been experiencing exactly what this listener commented when she said, previously it said you had a certain deadline, but she was able to correct it, earnings that were farther back than that 3 year, 3 month, and 15 day period. I've seen that as well. I've had people get their earnings record corrected, even if it was much longer ago than the 3 year, 3 month, and 15 day limit that is officially the rule. So I'm not aware that they've officially changed that rule. I think just internally they've got a policy where they're not enforcing that rule. That's the sense that I get, because I haven't seen a formal removal of that rule in the POMS. Maybe it has been removed and I just haven't picked up on it, but, they don't seem to be enforcing that. So that's the good news. The bad news is you're going to have to provide some evidence of the fact that your earnings are different than what they have recorded, which can be a little tough if you're looking at earnings back 5, 10, 15 years ago. Many times the employer that was supposed to report those earnings is no longer around, especially if it was a small employer that went out of business or what have you, or maybe don't keep records back that far. Large businesses that are still around probably could dig up your records for you, but otherwise you'll need to provide, I don't know, pay stubs, copies of tax returns, things like that to provide evidence that your earnings were different than what they've got officially recorded. So that might be a little tough if you're not a record keeper by nature. But the good news is that you've got more time, but it'd be in your best interest to get it corrected sooner than later, because the likelihood of having evidence to support the correction is much greater too. That's why I kind of stick to that general rule of checking your earnings record every couple of years. That should be adequate to make sure things are in line here.
All righty. Well, that was good. That was a good take. So we've got a couple of these things that she wants to talk about, Chris. So that was her first part. Her second part, and you can probably dive a little bit down a rabbit hole on this one, but she wants to point out to people the marriage requirement of 10 years for collecting on a spouse's record. If contemplating a divorce, take that into consideration. Also, take into consideration remarriage rules. Mm-hmm. I do want to point that out because it's been a while since we probably called it out specifically. But if you are planning on getting a divorce, you have to be married. Correct me if I'm wrong, Chris. Is it the year from year to year or is it date to date? And literally, how hard are they on that 10 years?
So the 10-year rule, which essentially grants you spousal benefits as if you were still married, even after you're divorced. The 10-year rule is date to date. They actually, to meet the 10 years, you've got to make it to your anniversary date, full 10 years. And there's no leniency that I'm aware of. If you miss it by a day, you're not going to have made the 10-year rule and will then not be eligible for divorced spouse or divorced survivor benefits on that previous spouse's record. So her point is correct. If you're considering divorce, you can be separated, you can be living apart, so you don't have to be together for the full 10 years, but you cannot be legally divorced prior to meeting that 10-year rule if you want to retain your eligibility for spousal or survivor benefits. So it's very important to look at that, and I would say any competent divorce attorney is going to know this rule. And if you're close, they should be talking to you about the ramifications of this to, be maybe legally separated or what have you, but don't finalize the divorce until after that 10-year anniversary. It can be advantageous actually to both spouses. There can be strategies for claiming that can be helpful to both of you. So it's not just a one or the other situation, although it is more important for the lower wage spouse, the lower benefit recipient spouse probably, to retain that. But there's always even a strategy available for the higher wage earning spouse if they meet that 10-year rule. So I think it's in both people's best interests. There's no downside. That's not like a divorced spouse benefit takes away from the other spouse. There's no downside to it other than you might have to be officially married for a little longer than you were planning on. So that's important. And the remarriage rules, if you are divorced and have this eligibility, say you were married for at least 10 years, you have to be careful of when you get remarried and the ramifications for that. So your spousal benefits are always going to switch to the new spouse if you remarry at any age. Spousal benefits, of course, are the benefits you receive from a spouse when the two of you are both alive. Now, survivor benefits are a little different. Survivor benefits, you can remarry after the age of 60 and not have it harm your survivor benefits. So people who know that age 60 rule are aware of that, but it would be very unfortunate if you had a very attractive survivor benefit available to you, but you remarried at 59 and a half, for instance, then you have foregone your ability to claim on that ex-spouse's benefit if they have passed away. And it might be larger than any benefit you might get with your new spouse, so there'd be an advantage to retaining eligibility for that. So being aware of those things, I think it's probably not practical for everyone to have all these nuanced rules memorized. Just keep in the back of your mind, there are rules surrounding divorced spouses and are rules with remarriage as it impacts your potential Social Security benefits. So if you're contemplating either one, either getting divorced or getting remarried, take a glance, refresh yourself, or ask someone who knows the Social Security rules to make sure there's not some financial reason that you might want to not maybe avoid getting remarried, for instance, but maybe alter the date a little bit or look at it and you be okay with the financial ramifications if there are some. Just you want to make these decisions eyes wide open so that you don't regret something that you could have easily avoided. It's always sad when I hear people were married for 9.5 years or something and their estate plan or their divorce attorney had them get divorced and it completely remove the ability for a spousal benefit for someone who needed it. And so that does happen occasionally. So you'll want to watch out for yourself and others, friends and family that might be going through those either divorce or remarriage instances and have them take a look at their Social Security benefits to make sure that they don't want to alter their plan a little bit.
Perfect. All righty. So we can get into the third bullet point of her PSA that she is sharing with us. Okay. This one is a little bit long, and she's sharing more of a story, but I think you'll be able to opine a little bit about what she's sharing. So bear with me, folks, as I try to read what she's going to describe. This is a true story. My mother-in-law was divorced and collecting on her Social Security earnings record. And she wrote in parentheses, my mother-in-law is a proud woman. This was many years ago. Her Social Security was approximately $400 a month. I was reading a book that I had checked out from the library on Social Security way back when my kids were young. And I realized my mother-in-law should be collecting on her ex-husband's amount as a divorced widower. So I guess they were married for 10 years if they're going to do the divorced part, Chris, and a widower. Oh, actually, no, you don't need to be married for 10 years for a divorced widower. I'll let you explain that little loophole nuance.
No, that's, you do.
You do have to be married for 10 years?
Yeah.
Oh, because they're divorced. They're divorced. Right, because of the divorce. Mm-hmm. Just a widower doesn't have to be married for 10 years. No. Okay. Their files, I'm guessing the files of these two people, folks, their files were never linked. So I called my mother-in-law, but due to medical issues, and she said it was only a couple of hundred dollars, she did not want to do it because of the medical expenses. Do it due to medical expenses. I don't quite follow what she's saying here at all, but I'll continue reading. But my mother-in-law could now get $900 a month. After talking with Social Security, I read she could also get 6 months retroactive. They had not mentioned this. When I called her, meaning the mother-in-law, when I called the mother-in-law and told her she could get $3,000 total retroactive, I asked her what she was going to do with all that money. I will never forget what she told me. She said, I'm going to buy a coat and some undergarments. Is that underwear? Undergarments? Is that how people way back when used to call underwear, right? Undergarments?
Some people still do.
Call it underwear. All right. So she's going to get a coat and some undergarments. Her last coat that she had was 20 years old, and it was given to her used. I can't help but think of her every time I hear Jim speak of the lady in the grocery store and purchasing the strawberries for her. Her doctor, her being the mother-in-law, her doctor worked with her for medicine samples. She also passed this information, I'm assuming the information on the lump sum backdating benefit. She also passed this information on to a few of her friends who were also divorced, and those friends benefited as well. The only part I don't understand is why the mother-in-law didn't want to do it because she was proud and she had medical issues. That's what was confusing me and still confuses me, Chris. I don't know. But I think this listener is trying to convey that, hey, I found my mother-in-law. She was essentially entitled to divorced spousal benefits and that she could file for them. It made me think, Chris, of a study that came out a couple of years ago by the, I think the GAO came out with it, but I could be wrong on that, finding that Social Security was not properly notifying widows or widowers that they are eligible for survivor benefits, significantly higher survivor benefits, And that they being Social Security, was going to try to make a better concerted effort to contact these people. Mm-hmm. But that over 100,000 beneficiaries, according to this study, were being shortchanged, mm-hmm. no pun intended. Yeah. And it sounds like this mother-in-law was being shortchanged for quite some time. Mm-hmm. And this woman was trying to help her. But being proud and due to medical issues, she didn't want to move forward until she found out she could get a lump sum $3,000 and then buy a new coat and undergarments.
Plus an extra $500 a month. Yeah,
I think there's a lot here that you can share with people about kind of walking through conceptually of the multitude of steps and rules involved here, but ways that our listeners, you guys are the VGers, like this listener was. This didn't help the listener, helped the listener's mother-in-law. You guys, I often say you're at the Vanguard, which is a tongue-in-cheek throwout to most of you have your money at Vanguard. But you're in the Vanguard where people generally come to you because they know you geek out on this stuff. So you might be able to help people as well maximize spousal benefits, divorce spouse benefits, survivor benefits. So what says you, Chris?
Yeah, the lesson to be learned here is that you need to be advocating for yourself and for your friends and family, because Social Security is not going to chase you down to pay you a benefit. When a married couple has filed and their records are linked in the system, so they know that you're married, there are generally some notifications and some automatic things that happen if one of you were to claim a benefit when you hadn't yet, opening up maybe a spousal benefit, or one of you gets reported as deceased, triggering a survivor benefit. But there's a lot of instances where those records are not connected, especially if you've been claiming for a very long period of time and you're divorced, right? In this case, it was divorced. I don't know how many years ago, but she had been collecting her own benefit for quite some time. But when that ex-spouse passed away, they didn't reach out to her and say, hey, now you have access to a survivor benefit. And it's $900 a month. You know, it goes from $400 to $900. That, you know, to a lot of people, $900 wouldn't sound like a lot, but when you're only getting $400, $900 is huge. That's a huge difference. And yes, you can file for survivor benefits retroactively, and the retroactive rules are you can claim retroactively up to 6 months or back to your full retirement age, whichever is less. So you can't claim retroactively to a month prior to your full retirement age, but this person's been receiving benefits for a long time, so they were, you know, obviously well beyond their full retirement age. But Social Security would have just let her collect $400 a month for the rest of her life, not paying her that $500 until someone pointed out, you need to go and ask for this. You are owed this, and you should put in a claim for this. So that's the good news. The sad part about it is likely left thousands of dollars on the table, because it sounds like the ex-spouse might have been, you know, deceased for a while. I'm just guessing. I'm surmising here. But that six-month retroactive limit makes it so you can't fix it all the way back if he passed away 5 or 6 years ago. Just think of all the money she didn't receive that she was owed. That would be the sad part about it. I'm glad they finally got it figured out, so she's got a noticeable increase in her benefit in the $3,000. Get a nice coat and some nice undergarments for sure. That was, you know, very life-changing. I'm sure increased her standard of living with those dollars, sounds like. So be on the lookout for stuff like that, and use what you learn from your own research and from podcasts like this, and this person read about Social Security, and share it, because most people aren't that interested in it. So they don't listen to podcasts like this. They don't read books on Social Security. They don't read articles. They just aren't that into it. So those people who are, like listeners out there, obviously, or you wouldn't have tuned in to this podcast, spread the wealth, you know, spread the knowledge, and ask questions when you're in social settings, and just see. And if they mention something, you don't have to pretend to be an expert. Just say, hey, I think there's something with your, I read about this, or, you know, you should look into this. You don't have to try to act like you're the all-knowing authority on it, but just knowing enough where you can trigger them to research it and maybe reach out to Social Security and ask. And you might make a really positive impact on someone's financial life with that information. So please do that as much as possible. You can help us spread the word.
That's kind of a good takeoff, Chris, onto her next bullet point, actually. She's encouraging people to learn all they can and spread the word. So she writes, I don't know how you can get the word out on the importance of building your Social Security record and knowing all the requirements. Well, we're getting the word out thanks to you writing to us, and we're talking about it on our podcast. Now, granted, we don't have the reach of on this podcast as like Joe Rogan has on his. God, imagine if we did. That'd be wild. But we're trying to get the word out there. So she continues writing, though. I'm sure you impart this knowledge on your students, Chris. Do you? You never really said. Do you talk to them deeply about Social Security? Or can they even relate to Social Security?
No, we talk about it because these are students that are ultimately trying to be financial planners. And so they need to know the rules for their clients. So we do go over it pretty extensively in a couple points in the curriculum.
Do you geek out on it and get really deep into the weeds like you do on the podcast?
We go medium, I would call it. If I, you know, their eyes already kind of gloss over once we start talking about the rules and when they realize that it's a lot more complicated than they thought. So I go medium deep, I would say. Not maybe quite as into the weeds as we do on the show here, but we go medium deep. It's not a, I'd say we do it at a bachelor's degree level, not a master's degree Social Security understanding level, if there were such a thing.
Okay, perfect. So she continues, encourage your listeners, that would be me trying to encourage you guys, encourage your listeners to impart this knowledge with their adult children, siblings, and others. And it's exactly what I say, folks. You're the vanguard on this. You're listening. You're learning Social Security. You're following some of the rules. You will someday come across someone you might be able to help, I'm sure. I am trying to share. This is the writer again, listeners. I am trying to share this with the younger people I know. I also share it with colleagues. I encourage everyone to print out a Social Security statement. I simply use the notebook method. I'm wondering if she means she prints out every statement that she can get and stores them in a notebook. But anyways, I think the main point she's trying to convey, listeners, try to pay attention if you can help people, especially like she helped her mother-in-law, and then the mother-in-law could get some undergarments and a new coat, as well as increase her Social Security benefit. I think that was all a wonderful thing. And then her final bullet point, Chris. When recently applying for Social Security, we did the delay to 70 for the higher earning and the full retirement age of the lower earner, I would assume, to ensure the most for our family. And I think that is for married couples. I won't say it's the just without a doubt the go-to norm, but I would say for the majority of people, that is most likely a reasonable approach.
It is if you're using Social Security in the way that we propose it be considered, which our focus on the use of Social Security is part of the longevity protection element, where it's part of the secure income package, if you will, that we want to be there as long as you live and with the survivor retaining as much as possible, since we all know that when you pass away, one of the Social Security benefits goes away. So that is a reasonable approach for most people if they have other resources to fund expenses prior to turning on the Social Security, and they don't have any other obvious reasons to divert from that strategy. I think it is reasonable for most. There's certainly occasions where something else makes more sense, but for the majority of people that have reasonable wealth built up beyond that, that if they're trying to build that foundation of secure income with Social Security as the first piece of that foundation, that higher wage earner at 70 and the lower wage earner at full retirement age works pretty well in most of the projections that I take a look at, and I've seen a lot of them.
Okay, and that wraps up our Social Security. I know we normally do two Social Security questions, folks, and maybe we'll jump into one, depends how the rest of the show goes. But I thought those were five kind of good bullet point PSA things that we could dive a little bit deeper into. And speaking of PSAs, Chris, we got another one in, more so related to Irma. And we got this one in a couple of weeks. Well, excuse me, we actually got it in last week, but it was in reference to something we spoke about the week before, where you asked specifically for someone to provide some feedback on. So it begins, "Hi, Jim and Chris. In 2023, my husband and I appealed our Irma surcharges." Why don't you real quickly, in case someone is just listening, explain what Irma surcharges are, in case people don't know?
So the Irma surcharge is the extra premium that you pay for your Part B and Part D Medicare premiums, Part B being the main Medicare and Part D being prescription drug plan, if your modified adjusted gross income is over certain limits each year, and those limits change every year, you will be charged more than the base fee for the Part B and the Part D. And so it's kind of an, it's effectively, because it's tied to your income, we consider it a form of a tax. But it's called a surcharge, or an adjusted amount, if you will. That's what IRMA stands for, income-related monthly adjustment amount. And it costs you more, you know, essentially, if you make too much, and it's tied to your Medicare premium. So it affects those who are on Medicare.
See, they should call it IRMAT, income-related monthly adjusted tax.
Yeah.
Because that's what it is. It's an IRMAT, but marketing and perception is everything. So it's Irma. And Irma just sounds so nice. Although, wasn't there a really bad hurricane named Irma? So maybe Irma's not quite as nice. I think there was a pretty big hurricane named Irma at some point in time, spelled differently than I-R-M-A-A.
Right.
Okay. This will kind of jog your memory on where she's going, Chris. She said, in 2023, my husband and I appealed our Irma. As it turned out, our income for the year exceeded our expectations. In 2025, that's this year, we had to repay all these Irma surcharges. But we were given the option to have the amount due deducted in January, which were deducted from our Social Security payments in February, or we could spread the amount owed out over 12 months. We chose to pay it all at once up front. So I guess that one deduction in January, which didn't arrive to February. I hope this helps you. And then they gave their full name, but we're going to call them George and Georgette from Texas.
Yeah, I knew there'd be somebody out there in listener land on the podcast who's experienced this. And the original question that I put out there was, if you appeal, which is what she was talking about, filing the SSA 44 form, which essentially asks them to use a different year for determining your income for Irma purposes, you give them an estimated amount of income you're going to expect in that year. And sometimes you make more than you expected. So they track this, and they trust you at first, and they'll reduce or remove the Irma that they otherwise were going to charge you based on your estimate. But then when the tax return gets filed, they'll check it. And if you made more, pushing you back up into Irma tiers, they're going to charge you for it. And the question was, what options do they give you to repay it? And she just provided the answer to that, and I really appreciate it. So they were given the option to just take care of it in a lump sum or spread it out over 12 months. And if they're collecting Social Security, have it withheld from their Social Security benefit. So it's nice that they give you that option, but be prepared. If you do file for relief with the SSA 44 and you use estimated AGI, estimated income levels, if your income ends up being higher than you estimated for any reason, you did a Roth conversion, who knows what, be prepared to get a letter stating, well, turns out in reality your income was higher, so you did owe us IRMA, either at a higher level or maybe you were out of it completely and they put you back into it, and here's the bill, and now we know you can have a couple of options. Pay it as a lump sum or over 12 months.
Hey, I like that. The next two questions, one is the new question of the week, and then one is an older question that kind of ties into the new question of the week. So I thought I would get to that one too.
Okay.
All right. I just don't know which one was the new question of the week and which one isn't. So let me click real quickly and see. This one was sent May 5th. So that is the new question of the week. Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay. It begins. Dear Jim and Chris, thank you and you and your firm for bringing timely and detailed information to your podcast listeners each week. Some of the deep dives provoke interest in subjects I didn't even know I cared about. I kind of like that. I didn't even know I liked that. I didn't even know I cared about that. So that's good. I mean, I know a lot of people, they'll read the show notes and the description or use the fast forward button, especially when Chris is rambling on for 40 minutes about something, and try to get to the end and just listen to things that they feel they would be interested in. But you, as this listener pointed out, I'm guessing he listens to the full shows and actually learns about things he never knew he would be interested in. He said, on a recent podcast, you took a deep dive into proper beneficiary titling of accounts. The subject in common about titling trusts as beneficiary of an IRA does keep coming up, but I don't really understand what the mechanics are with doing this. I know the problem has something to do with RMDs and Secure Act 2, but other than that, I know very little about titling. Any light you can shed on this subject would be most appreciated. Again, thanks for all you do to entertain us and make us more informed. And he gives his true name, but we are going to call him George. And we don't, he did give a question. I don't have ChatGPT up. I have a new way, Chris, I will share later on how you can play against ChatGPT. And I think I solved for good ChatGPT's ability to cheat. You'll see. I think what I came up with was brilliant, but that's just my unbiased opinion. But we'll launch this new way of state hints later. His state hint, for those who are curious, he's from the state where Babe Ruth was born. Do you want to try real quick to guess that, Chris? If not, I'm just going to give the answer.
New York.
Close, Maryland. Hmm. That's close. Maryland's not too far from New York.
No.
Okay. So here's the thing with titling, because we do say all the time, properly titled inherited IRA or inherited IRA titled to the name of the beneficiary or inherited IRA titled to the name of the trust. And he's wondering, how do I do this? Here's how you do it. On the application, you click the button or the little box that simply indicates this is an inherited account. The custodian will do all the titling. Not you. Custodians do not want to leave this to you or to anyone else. You're at least listening to podcasts and learning and geeking out on this. 99 out of 100 people could give a damn about this and wouldn't know how to title. Custodians aren't going to let you. I can only imagine the titles that they would end up getting. Inherited IRA, I inherited from my long lost mom and dad. I mean, you can just see how some things would happen. So when you open accounts, you either let the custodian know, well, few people even have to call anymore. When you're getting the forms from the custodian, or if you're on the phone, if you're doing it the old-fashioned way, let the phone rep or let the search box know this is an inherited IRA. Some custodians I have seen have one application and checkbox everywhere where you're going to indicate this is an inherited account. And then if so, they're going to ask additional questions. Who did you inherit it from? What was their date of birth? What was their date of death? Things of that nature. Others will have applications specifically for opening inherited accounts. And also what they're going to ask you is questions on the decedent. Who was he or she? What was their date of birth? What was their date of death? They will handle all the titling, not you. So that's one reason Chris and I don't get into how to actually title it. We've mentioned many times what Ed Slott's opinion is and how he, if he was a custodian, would title accounts. His way and his manner is very crisp and clear. But custodians don't do it that way. I have seen titling with shortened versions for beneficiary like B-E-N-E and D-E-C-D for decedent and all sorts of things in the title. Mm-hmm. Just convey to the custodian, this is a beneficiary IRA. That's all you have to do. The custodian will ask you questions about the decedent and will properly title the trust based on the person or thing, in the case of a trust, that's inheriting the account. And if it's a person, you're going to list the beneficiary's information. If it's a trust, they're going to ask very similar questions, but slightly different because it's a trust. They might ask for the TIN, the tax identification number. They might ask for the cover page of the trust or the full trust or the trust creation date. They'll definitely ask for that. So there's going to be certain things depending on who the beneficiary is, a person or a thing, that they're also going to ask. Most custodians that, and again, I haven't opened an account directly got in over 10 years, so I'm probably dating myself. I have staff that does that now, and we outsource to a company actually in our office who specializes with just opening accounts at Schwab. So my staff doesn't even have to do that. We can outsource it out. So they know how to do all that. But you as a do-it-yourselfer, either start with somebody on the phone or on the website, make it perfectly clear this is a beneficiary account, and the custodian will do the titling. Anything you want to add, Chris?
No, I think the custodian has ultimate control over what they set up on the account, so you're not going to be able to have complete discretion. So I think your point of indicating it's inherited and letting them do the titling is correct. I think he talked about beneficiaries, and he used the word titling. I'm not sure that the question wasn't even more along the lines of, you know, naming beneficiaries and naming a trust as beneficiary. How does one even do that? Maybe the question was more simple. He, you know, yes, he used the word titling, but I don't think it was like after the decedent had passed, but rather how do you fill out the beneficiary designation form and name the trust, which you do exactly that. As you're filling out the beneficiary designation form for the account, if you want the trust as beneficiary, you've got to name the trust either as, you know, primary or contingent or however you're trying to set it up. We recommend that you only include a trust as one of the beneficiaries on the beneficiary form if there's a clear and definitive reason to add that complexity, because it can be a tax and rules minefield after the owner of the account passes away that you might not want the beneficiaries to have to navigate that minefield and maybe have excessive taxes that could have been avoided had the trust not been part of the beneficiary form. So that's why we, you know, generally encourage people to think twice about using a trust as one of the beneficiaries on the form. And so maybe that was also kind of part of the question in their mind as well.
You know, I think, Chris, after listening to you and rereading, I think you're right. I think I misinterpreted. I thought, how does he title a inherited IRA correctly? I think he was asking, how do I name a trust as beneficiary of an IRA? I think he's living, he's not dead, and he wants to name a trust as beneficiary. That's what you think he means too now, right?
I think that was his question. I'm not sure he wants to do it, but he's just trying to understand, you know, how one would do it, and he's heard us warn against it and things like that. So he's just more curious about it. I don't know if that was what he wants to do, but if he's looking into that, then certainly, you know, take my advice, hopefully. Think twice and consult with your attorney to make sure that it's going to do what you want to do without any unintended side effects or unwanted side effects, particularly from a tax and complexity standpoint. There, if done a certain way, it might not cause side effects that you dislike. But if it's done incorrectly or inappropriately, there might be side effects that you really would not want to happen. And the challenge is the side effects don't show up until after you're gone. It's not going to harm you. It's going to harm who you're trying to leave the money to, potentially. You know, can work out. I'm not saying it always blows up. We've never said that. We've just always said, be careful. This is, you know, fraught with the potential to expose these dollars to taxes that otherwise it could avoid, and complexities that may not be necessarily or needed. And make sure that's the way you want to do it. And if you're going down that path, make sure the trust is built properly to do what you want, and go into it eyes wide open. That's what we ask before you willy-nilly put a trust down as beneficiary of on the form.
Absolutely. And thanks for picking up on that, Chris, because I misunderstood. So I don't know. Well, at least people got to learn a little bit of both. How do you actually title an inherited account? You let the custodian do it. But how do you name a trust on a beneficiary form? You just write the trust information down on the beneficiary form. Now, what I would recommend is you talk to the attorney who created the trust and ask them, what is the title of the trust that I should list on the beneficiary form? And they better, if they don't, get a new attorney, give you the exact titling that they want you to use on the beneficiary form. Don't just write my trust or trust I created January 4th, 2026. Get the title from the attorney. We always, if in the few instances where clients of ours are going to name a trust after getting through my gauntlet of questions of why are you doing this, and if they're still going to move forward, I specifically tell them, I want the exact titling from the attorney. And then we just put that on the beneficiary form. And it's just that easy, folks. Now, a couple of little rabbit holes I'll go down here, folks. Not all custodians will accept trusts. The big ones, they will. So if you're a Vanguardian or a Schwabian or a Fidelian, they're going to accept trusts. But not every custodian will accept trusts as beneficiaries. So theoretically, you should first confirm with your custodian if trusts are accepted. Some beneficiary forms have actual little check boxes where you indicate the beneficiary is a trust. So that's kind of a good way to know if they've got that checkbox, they're pretty much going to accept the trust. They just want you telling them, and they want to be able to call out quickly that this is a trust. But another thing, and you're going to get kickback from your attorney on this, and you probably know where I'm going with this, Chris. When filling in the beneficiary form, the attorneys, very proud people, attorneys, just like that woman who was too proud to file on her deceased divorced husband until she found out she can get $3,000 and then go buy a coat and some underwear. The woman who wrote that email said she was a proud woman. Well, attorneys are very proud, and they think everything they do is perfect. And they're going to tell you, just name on the primary beneficiary form the trust. And they're probably going to tell you don't need contingent beneficiaries on the form. I took care of everything with the trust. That trust is perfect. Trust is wonderful. It's beautiful. Look at it. It's a big, beautiful trust. It's wonderful. I'm telling you, you should name contingents on your IRA beneficiary form. Because Chris rightly pointed out, if the trust all works out, wonderful. And it's not you who's going to be screwed. You know why it's not going to be you being screwed? Chris will tell you in a minute. Well, Chris, tell him right now, why isn't the dead guy the one being screwed?
Because they're dead.
They're dead. You're gone. You're not left dealing with it. People are left dealing with what you left them. And if the trust, either because of incompetence on behalf of the attorney or lifestyle changes that you never relayed to a very competent attorney who could then proactively say, my God, we have to update this trust. So it's either going to be caused by the attorney or by you. But for some reason, this trust no longer makes sense. Or a tax law change, i.e. SECURE. SECURE changed a lot on naming trusts as beneficiaries of IRAs, especially those with conduit trusts. We won't get deep into it here. We've talked about it in early 2000 when Secure first came out. And people were left hanging, and there were stories of people who died post-Secure, January 1st, 2nd, 3rd of 2020, Secure's new rules come in, and their trust, which was brilliant up to December 31st of 2019, was all of a sudden the worst freaking thing to have because of changes in Secure 1, yet they were never grandfathered in, unless you were a government employee. Then you were grandfathered in, at least for your government TSP or any other type of government retirement account. They had 2 years to fix their stuff, but everyone else didn't. Don't get me going on that, how they passed certain rules to help themselves and nobody else. Don't get me going. But that said, a lot of people ran into issues with trusts because the government just changed the rules. So there could be a time or a reason or a cause where that trust that you have on that beneficiary form no longer makes sense and you're dead. You died. And your beneficiaries, perhaps the beneficiaries of the trust themselves, are thinking, oh, God, why did Dad do this? Why did they listen to that guy with the mastery of the English language and that non-Bostonian, purely English-sounding voice? Why didn't they listen to him and not name the trust? Now we're stuck with this trust. Chris, if the dead guy had put humans on the IRA beneficiary form, what conceptually could have been done or can be done that can't be if there's no human contingents?
Yeah. If the trust grants the trustee the power to disclaim, the trustee could say, oh, things have changed, and it's not in the best interest of the beneficiaries, ultimately, to have it pass into the trust first. Let's just step out of the way and let it pass to the contingents. If there are no contingents listed, that doesn't work. If they step aside, then it goes to generally the estate or whatever would be, you know, the custodian set up as the default beneficiary if there is no beneficiary. But if you've got a name or names on that contingent line on the beneficiary form, the primary can simply step back from part or all of the, quote, inheritance and let it flow to what's named on the contingent. It's quite a powerful planning tool as a kind of an escape hatch, if you will, that things have changed or things are not good if the trust receives these assets. It would be better to have them flow directly to the contingents. And so you just give yourself, it doesn't force the trust to do that, the trustee to do that, but it gives the trustee an option. And what a proud estate planning attorney, if they are saying, oh, don't bother doing that, they're essentially saying there's no possible way I could see in the future where you'd want to do that. Well, unless they can tell the future, they can't possibly anticipate how tax laws or other things might change that would cause a trustee to want to do this. So what's the harm in putting it on there? That's our point. There's no harm in listing them as contingents. So go ahead and do that. And, of course, the trustee will have to have the power to disclaim, have to be able to step out of the way. So I think that would have to be added to the trust as well. But I don't think a trustee without the explicit power to do that would be allowed to step aside. But that's, you know, I'm not an attorney, so I can't say that for sure. Maybe Jim's looked into this enough to know for sure if that wording needs to be in the trust.
I'm not 100% certain, Chris, if that wording needs to be in there or not. My gut tells me it probably does, but I'm not 100% certain either. And if somebody knows, if there's an estate planning attorney out there, does the ability for the trustee to disclaim, must that be a granted power in the trust? Or is it just assumed that anybody can disclaim? So a trustee could theoretically disclaim if they want it. My gut tells me it's got to be granted inside the trust.
Yeah.
But I'm not 100% certain. Anyways, good question. And again, I took it from two different approaches now because I interpreted it differently. So I don't know if my first answer or our second answer was what this gentleman was looking for, but hopefully it helped. All right. The only reason this last question is kind of related to the first question, it's short and it lends itself to a very short answer like this last one. So I can keep this question much shorter, Chris.
Okay, good.
Hi, Jim and Chris. Actually, this must be coming from a CPA or a planner or someone, because I didn't realize it says, hi, Jim and Chris, my client, Georgette, is age 70. She assisted her dad, who was 96, with a deathbed Roth IRA conversion. And what a deathbed Roth conversion is, not a special conversion per se that the IRC, Internal Revenue Code, identifies. It's literally what it sounds like. Her dad wasn't far from passing, but they realized from a tax perspective, it made more sense for the dad to pay taxes on a conversion and pass the assets on to the daughter as a Roth than it would be for the daughter to receive the inheritance inside an IRA. There's nothing shared here on how the taxes were paid, but they could have been paid directly from the conversion or from other assets that the dad had. We have done, quote unquote, deathbed conversions in the past. Sadly, as some of our clients have passed, we've worked with their beneficiaries, but it's not something you want a knee-jerk reaction do. It may not make sense, but if it does make sense and you crunch the numbers and you do a tax projection, a deathbed conversion, there's no look-back period for conversions. The taxes will be on the decedent's taxes. It's not like, oh, they have to live for X number of years for the conversion to be true. Conversions can happen right up to the last breath you take. And it sounds to me it was close because they continue. The father, the dad, never had a Roth IRA. And he sadly passed away 2 days after the conversion was done. And that's fine. There's no revocation of the conversion because he didn't live a certain amount of time. There are rules in the tax code and with Social Security that you have to live for a certain period of time to get a survivor benefit or the divorced spouse benefit, as Chris just said, with the 10-year rule. And what is it for survivor? Is it, it's 8 months for like a sickness, but no wait for an accident or something like that in Social Security, right, Chris?
So you have to be married 9 months to qualify for survivor benefits, 12 months for spousal benefits. However, for the survivor benefits, there's a lot of exceptions to the 9-month rule. If you, if it's an accident or you're killed in military action, or if you have a child of the decedent, together, they waive the 9-month rule. So there's a lot of ways to not have to worry about the 9-month rule, but it's technically a 9-month commitment to qualify for survivor benefits.
Okay. So she continues now, this writer, with their question. My question is, are the beneficiaries required to hold this inherited Roth for 5 years before taking any money out of the inherited Roth IRA since it was only funded 2 days before? Yes and no. So let's look at a few things. If a spouse is inheriting it, totally different rules. We're not going to go that route. This gentleman was 96 years old. There was no mention of a spouse inheriting anything. So we're going to non-spouses. But a spouse has different rule. Chris, on an inherited Roth, is it technically the dead guy's Roth or the living guy's Roth?
It's technically still the dead guy's Roth with the living beneficiary, simply the beneficiary of the account.
Exactly. So keep that in mind. That's why it's different for spouses. Spouses can treat the decedents as their own. They can move it to their own. Spouses, this rule will not apply. But for a decedent who's, excuse me, for in this case, a decedent who passes away with a Roth less than 5 years old. In this case, it was only 2 days old, but technically it was already 1 year old. And if he died on December 3rd, excuse me, if he converted on December 31st, but died January 2nd, the Roth is already 2 years old.
Right.
We don't have any dates of when he died, but the Roth is already 1 year old. I can tell you it's at least one. Technically speaking, it could be two in the scenario I just described.
For counting purposes, yeah.
For counting purposes. However, the decedents inherit, excuse me, these beneficiaries inheriting it, it's not their Roth. It's the decedent's Roth. They're just beneficiaries of it. So every beneficiary, whether it's the one person or 10 people, they could have Roths that have been open since 1998 when Roths first came around. And it does not matter.
Doesn't
because
apply.
Because those, right. Pardon?
Doesn't apply to this because it's not theirs.
Right. Because their Roths are their Roths. This Roth is the decedent's Roth. Do they have to wait 5 years to take any money out? No.
No.
Not at all. Because remember, to get a qualified distribution from a Roth IRA is number one, the Roth has to be 5 years old. So they failed on that. We already said that. The Roth is not 5 years old. But number two, they have to be dead, disabled, over the age of 59 and a half, or buying a first-time home. Death comes into play here. So death comes into play. Even though this is a conversion, and theoretically conversions have to sit inside a Roth for 5 years before you take them out, if the decedent, this the woman they're writing about is 70, the one who inherited it, but what if one of the beneficiaries is a 10-year-old great-grandson of the decedent who died at 96? He doesn't have a Roth. He's 10 years old. And he's not over 59 and a half. He's 10 years old. But because he inherited it due to death, the 10% early withdrawal penalty goes away. And that second five-year rule of conversions having to sit inside a Roth for 5 years before you take money out or you're going to pay a 10% penalty, that died, no pun intended, with the decedent. So here's what's going to happen when they move to their own.
The decedent was well over 59 and a half, so that five-year conversion rule wouldn't have applied to anybody. Wouldn't apply to him if he lived. Right.
He could have converted and
taken the
not
money
died
out
2 days later. He could have took the money out 2 days later and right before he died.
Correct.
And he wouldn't have been hit with a 10% early withdrawal penalty.
Correct.
So what's going to happen is the beneficiaries will open up a beneficiary IRA, just like we explained how earlier, at a custodian, maybe the same custodian where the IRA is. And they're allowed to take out all the money in that Roth. But if they take out any growth, there will be taxes owed. To get the growth out, you need that qualified distribution. This gentleman did not satisfy the two prongs. The first prong, Roth has to be 5 years old. This isn't. He failed right there. Second prong, the IRA owner is over the age of 59 and a half, dead, disabled, or buying a first-time home. Sadly, this gentleman is the second one, passed away. He's deceased. But only one of the two prongs was satisfied. That five-year prong must still remain to get the earnings out. So let me just give you a numerical example.
But only the earnings.
Correct, only the earnings.
The converted amount is available.
Let's just say the beneficiary inherits $100,000 of this decedent's newly converted Roth. As I already said, the Roth is already 1 year old. You're going to start measuring from the year of conversion. This email came in April of this year. So let's just assume the gentleman died in April of 2025. The beneficiary already has $100,000 and the Roth is 1 year old. to get any earnings out, the beneficiary's got to wait 4 more years. They got to get 5 years, and only to January. They don't have to wait till April, just till January. However, there's $100,000 sitting in there, and the beneficiary has no RMDs, does not matter, under Secure 2. A beneficiary has 10 years to close that Roth. And after 10 years, clearly the Roth would have been 5 years old because you go in 10. So they can close the entire Roth in 10 years, let it sit there and grow for 10 years, close it in 10 years, 100% tax-free. But they get 2 years into it and they want to buy a house. And they're thinking, wow, I've got $130,000 in that Roth. I'm just saying over the last 2 years, it grew 30%. That's a good amount of growth, I admit, but follow the math. So now 2 years into this 10-year hold, 2 more years into a 5-year hold to get the earnings out tax-free, they want to close the Roth and they want all $130,000. Chris, how much of that $130,000 will be taxable to them?
Unfortunately, the 30 will be, but the good news is the 100 is not. The 100 was available immediately because taxes have already been paid on that. It's just the growth that has to be qualified with that 5-year rule for it to come out tax-free. And it's just the 30,000 then that's exposed to it. They would have to hold that. That would have to meet the 5 years, which, remember, the decedent may have satisfied 1 or 2 years. But we're assuming that they're closing it now before that full 5 years has been met to get a qualified distribution. So the 30 grand alone would be taxable.
And this still follows the layer cake analogy I like to give. Mm-hmm. Contributions come out first.
Yep.
There were none. Conversions come out second. It's all a conversion.
Yep.
Earnings come out third. Unlike after-tax basis in a traditional IRA, which we call cream in the coffee, it mixes through, and every distribution from an IRA will contain a bit of after-tax basis. There's no cream in the coffee with a Roth distribution. It's a layer cake or a stack of pancakes, if you will. The first stack on the bottom of the plate was contributions. There were none. Second stack is conversions. There is. So there's a stack of $100,000 worth of pancakes. The next stack, the next pancake, is a $30,000 of growth. The beneficiary could say, I don't want the top pancake, that $30,000 pancake. I just want the $100,000 pancake. Government says, no problem. Just take that $100,000 pancake out. You'll track it on 8606, but you can just take that $100,000 out. Perfect. No problem.
Yep.
So in the analogy that I'm giving or the example I'm giving, if the person buying the house is thinking, oh God, $30,000 of additional earnings, I'm going to lose $20,000 of it due to taxes. It's not worth it for me to use it to just net 10 grand for my down payment. I'm only going to take the $100,000 out. No harm, no foul.
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah, that was kind a good of a one. Deeper kind of dive, interesting.
But
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Interesting, yeah.
Yeah.
And I think that probably wraps up the show.
Yeah, it does. It's a good stopping spot. So that, you know, the first Social Security list was kind of 5 and 1 we talked about a little bit. So we got a little farther. We did eat up about 11 or 12 minutes of lawn and garden talk at the front end, but 'tis the season for lawn and gardening. So forgive us if you're not into lawns and gardens. Yeah. So let's see. Next week we have a Q&A show. Next week I think will be the week where Jim will not be joining us. So it'll be a show with myself and Jake and Jacob, the two Jakes, I guess. We'll be manning the Q&A show next week. We've got, I'll re-mention that we've got a special guest, Kevin Sebesta, who does some coaching with the Rock Retirement Club that we've mentioned on the show before. He's going to join us and talk about some retirement considerations, we'll call them, that maybe we don't talk about regularly on the show. So that'll be part of the EDU show this coming week, and then maybe probably the week after that as well. So that's what's coming up. And Jim, I know you're heading out traveling again next week.
I will be. I'll be in Atlanta on the. I arrive the night of the 14th, and I leave the evening of the 16th. So I'm not going to be in Atlanta long, but I fly to Ohio the evening of Friday the 16th. Right. And the only thing that stinks, Chris, is the Ed Slott program ends at 1 o'clock, but my plane doesn't leave until 5. So I'll probably go. There's got to be something around the hotel, I'm sure, that I can walk to and spend a few hours, relax somewhere, and take in some sights of Atlanta before flying to Ohio. And then I'll be in Ohio from the 16th, Friday the 16th. And then I fly back. I think it's the 21st. If 21st is a Wednesday, that's the day I fly back. It is. So I'll fly back to Colorado on the 21st. I have to iron out a few things with the apartment complex for the apartment that I'm renting. And I bought a Ford Maverick pickup truck. So I need to go to the dealer. I bought it online. I want to meet the salesman in person. So I'm going to go check him out. There's a couple of friends I'm going to get together with. So I'll have a couple of days in Ohio before coming back to Colorado and jumping into my garden with 2 feet this time to get all the planting done in a 3-week time frame that I give myself to get everything planted, Chris. Nice.
And did they get your apartment building repaired after that person?
No, they called me. I have to meet this woman who drove, apparently, she did it right. She slammed the hell out of this building, and they had to extract the entire vehicle from inside. So they're still repairing it. They anticipate completing all repairs by the end of May, and then they have to wait for an inspection in the city to give them an occupancy permit again. I don't know if this woman will move back into her apartment or where she'll move. I just hope I'm never sleeping on my third floor apartment and feel another bang and shudder and movement, because I'll be again. I don't know who drove into it, but I'm sure someday I will find out. I would assume everybody in the apartment complex knows who it is that drove the car into her living room.
Put up more substantial barriers to prevent that.
Perhaps, maybe they will. But, accidents happen. I can tell you, as a former police officer, we've heard it all and seen it all. Accidents happen. And yep. I'm just grateful nobody got injured, that the woman did not get injured. I'm sure her pride is injured. And I'm sure her insurance claim is quite large against her. But outside of that, I don't know much. I'm hoping it's done by June. And I can start moving some things there and spending a little bit more time in Ohio and Kentucky. And someone recently suggested I check out some hiking areas in Indiana and some deer hunting areas, perhaps in Indiana. So I'll be hopefully visiting that whole Midwest area as I try to decide, folks, does the older Jim want to be in the Ohio River Valley area? Or does he want to be in Colorado? And so far, I'm still leaning towards Ohio for sure, or the Ohio River Valley area. And everything I'm doing is in an effort for the younger Jim to give the older Jim a retirement that he should hopefully enjoy. And since the younger Jim enjoys gardening so much, and it is so incredibly difficult in Colorado to do, I'm trying to make it as easy as possible for older Jim, 75, 80, 85-year-old Jim, to be thankful and say, wow, I might be old and slow, but I can still get out and grow. And it rains and water falls from the sky.
Well, I'm glad you're doing the research ahead of time so you don't just up and move out there and then discover,
funny, but it just makes you realize, listeners, how we change as we age. When I moved to Colorado, I was in my mid-30s. I had just reached mid-30. I thought I was old. And I moved with absolutely no job. I flew out as a cop, bought a house within 30 days on my police officer's salary, told him it was a vacation home, got a vacation home, I told him, is what it was. And didn't think anything of it, flew back home, resigned from the police force. 2 weeks later, moved to Colorado. No job, knew nobody, didn't care. Didn't care at all. Now, I was smart. I did have enough money to cover my mortgage for 2 years. I could make zero and not have to worry about the mortgage for 2 years. In hindsight, I probably should have went closer to 3 years, but I went two. And my mom, God bless her, gave me $300 a month from her Social Security check when I first moved. And that allowed me to buy food. And you might be thinking, food for $300 a month? That was $300 a month 26 years ago, folks. And I was a single man, no wife, no kids. $300 a month, I ate quite nicely. And that's how I funded it. And I didn't care. Fast forward to today and look at everything that I'm doing. Yeah. We are much more methodical. We try to think things through. I'm trying to make sure I'm going to like it. I'm hesitant to actually purchase a house because I know gardening, Jim, is anxious to get out there. Fall foliage, hardwood forest loving Jim is anxious to get out there. But elk hunting and mountain hiking Jim is hesitant to leave Colorado. And gardening Jim is just confused as hell because he doesn't know what he's going to be doing in a couple of years. But my point is, we think of things and we're much more methodical as we get older. And it makes total sense what I'm doing from a behavioral aspect that I'm analyzing to make sure. Because one of the things we have seen as retirement planners are even people we work with making, I call it vacation decisions. They visit a place to see kids or grandkids or just go on vacation, or they visited Florida all the time for a week or two in the winter and they thought, I want to live here forever. And they retire and they just move. And they only move based on knowing an area as a vacationer. Mm-hmm. And they think living out there every day is going to be like a vacation. I can tell you, living in Colorado, every day is not like a vacation. You start to see the beauty is here, especially if you look west. You look north, south, or east, it's not so beautiful. But you look west or drive west, you're in awe. How could you ever leave this? It's gorgeous. Because 365 days a year, I'm living Colorado, and I know the downsides of living out here. And it's that I don't want to fall victim, if you will, to moving under vacation Jim because he's gone out to Ohio a few times and liked it and met some nice people. I now have to actually live there, hence the apartment, the Ford Maverick truck, and I'll be spending a lot more time in Ohio, a lot more time. And it's all in an effort to make sure I truly want to be there, that I can handle 3 days of solid rain and not go bonkers in my apartment.
Yeah.
But I can handle July humidity or August humidity. I think, Chris, you'll remember, I don't know if I called you or emailed you when I was driving the first time in 2021, getting out of my car. I was still in Indiana. I hadn't quite reached Ohio yet. And I told you the humidity, I couldn't believe it. It was like walking into a wall of water. Mm-hmm. It had been so long since I experienced humidity. Chris is adamant. If I stay out there in the summer, I'm not going to want to move. Well, I have to go there and experience and see if he's right. And I think everybody who's contemplating relocating as a retiree, don't do so on a vacation mindset. And there's nothing wrong. You don't have to buy a house right away. That's why I'm renting. Mm-hmm. I'm going from 10 acres of land and a nice house to living in an apartment. Probably 3 or 4 months a year now, I'm going to be in an apartment, and the remaining, I'll still be in my house. But it's because I'm trying to experience what life will be there in all four seasons, in all types of weather, just to make sure I'm truly certain I can live here. And we talked before on the show about people sharing with us a joke that people in the Carolinas called people who moved to Florida from the north. And do you remember what that joke is, Chris?
No.
Halfbacks.
Oh, that's right.
That people, and I never knew what it was until I can't remember if it was a South Carolinian or a North Carolinian told us. They call them halfbacks, that people from the north, usually Michigan, Minnesota, Wisconsin, move to Florida in retirement and then realize, damn, Florida's nice in the winter, but summer's not so much. And their summer is 8 months long. But they don't want to go back to the cold state, so they move halfway back. And people in the Carolinas, and I would assume Tennessee, call them halfbacks. Not in a derogatory sense. It's just they're moving halfway back because they realize you can't judge living in an area based on a two-week vacation you happen to take. So I'm just hopefully you guys will find this helpful as you try to decide what you're going to do in retirement. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with renting. I'm going to rent for at least 3 years. And there's nothing wrong. I mean, some people will poke holes in what I'm doing and say I'm wasting my money because 8 months of the year, 9 months of the year, you're not even in the apartment and you're spending money on rent. Sure. But I'm doing it for the convenience. So I can walk on a plane and not have to bring suitcases. I can leave my hiking gear out there. I can leave a vehicle out there. I can leave everything that I want. And when I'm in an apartment, I feel like I'm at home. I'm not living out of a Staybridge suite or some Airbnb. That's not mine. So I'm willing to pay these extra dollars in an effort to get a good sense of if I should relocate in retirement. Because it's one thing to move when you're 30. It's another thing to move when you're 60 or 70 and then have to do it all over again because 5, 6, 7 years into it, you don't like it. And now you're 70 or 80. So try to get it right and don't fall victim to the rose-colored vacation glasses. And there's nothing wrong with renting for a year or so to make sure you really want to be there. Yeah. Okay, that's good my point. Little tirade, Chris. Sorry about that.
No, it's okay. Nice to hear. I think it's good advice for people to go out and spend some extended time in a place they're looking to relocate to. That's wise words, in my opinion. So thanks, everybody, for listening. Thanks for shooting us your questions. If you want to send your own questions, send them to Jim directly, jim@jimhelps.com. That's jim@jimhelps.com. Put in the subject line, it's a question for the podcast, and include a word or two about the topic. And we'll do our best to get you an answer here on the show. That's all I have to say today. So everybody take care, and we will be back with you next week with a brand new show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now you may wonder what sets Jim Salmier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Salmier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's jimhelps.com or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salmier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.